Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rates and Lanes with your hosts, Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The Rates and Lanes podcast rides again. I'm your host, Rico Muhammad. I will be joined here shortly by my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. And tonight we have a special guest with on board with us this evening, friend of the show now. I think this is his third appearance here on the podcast. Great and insightful and informative Mr. Noel Perry is joining us tonight as our guest. But before we get to Chuck and Mr. Perry, I'm going to jump into this week's spot market report from DAT, the trend lines report, I should say, showing us that the national average price of diesel fuel is kind of got that creeping incrementalism going on for itself right now. It's up 2.2 percentage points. So the national average has climbed from last week up to a national average of $3.14 per gallon nationwide average. And 3 weeks after the devastating polar vortex weather event upended freight markets, a more normal pattern of activity emerged in the dry van and reefer markets last week. Load posts dropped by 23% and capacity eased slightly with close to 10% more truck posts. Flatbeds was quite the opposite, though volume up 3% week over week, and capacity has tightened. So let's take a deeper dive and see how each segment type has been performing over the week, starting out with the dry vans, and we're going to begin up in the northeastern portion of the United States. We're showing an average outbound spot market rate for dry vans at $2.44 per mile. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern portion of the United States, we're showing an average outbound rate for dry vans at $2.55. Climbing back up into the Midwest, we're showing an average outbound rate of $2.98. Sliding back down to the south central region of the United States, we're showing an average rate of $2.31. And wrapping up for dry vans coming out of the West Coast, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate of $2.58 per mile. Jumping over to the flatbed portion of the report, over the previous week, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate for flatbeds coming out of the Northeast is at $2.67. Moving down to the southeastern and mid-Atlantic states, we're showing an average outbound rate for flatbeds at $2.82 per mile. Climbing back up into the Midwest, we're showing that average spot market rate for flatbeds at $3.16. Moving down to the south central region of the United States, we're showing an average outbound rate for flatbeds at $2.37. And wrapping up, coming out of the West Coast, we're showing average outbound spot market rates. And wrapping up the DAT report for this week, we're showing for temperature control or reefer portion of the report, starting out in the Northeast, we're showing that average outbound spot market rate at $2.64. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern portion of the United States, we're showing that rate at $2.58 per mile. Climbing back up into the Midwest, we're showing average outbound rates for reefers at $3.33. Coming out of the south central region of the United States, we're showing average outbound rates at $2.74. And wrapping up, closing out this week's report, coming out of the West Coast for reefers, we're showing that outbound spot market rate is averaging at $2.92 per mile. And so with that being said, and we don't have good news to report, we don't have any bad news to report as far as the bad broker report, which is always good news. And with that being said, let me go and grab my co-host and welcome him up and on board. Good evening, Chuck. How are you?
We're doing well, Rico. How you doing?
I tell you, I really can't complain, Chuck. If it got any better, I might have to pinch myself.
Well, I want to say this publicly. Congratulations, buddy, on your engagement. Can't wait to dance at your wedding, buddy.
Well, let's see if we can make it now.
Okay.
Let's see if okay. We can make it there. We got the hard part out of the way, I guess, for now. We'll see how things develop.
Okay, well, congratulations.
And with that said, I don't like to keep our guests waiting. Let me go and grab insightful gentleman that is starting to love to have him on the show, Mr. Noel Perry. Noel, good evening. How are you?
I'm fine, Rico. One piece of advice, by the way, it really pays to overmarry. I did it. That's lasted 52 years now.
Well said, Noel. Well said. You know what?
Yes.
We should actually probably talk about this tonight because, really, I've been with the same woman for 43 years. And you know, a huge part of my success is who I'm married to. It's the biggest decision and the most important decision that you're ever going to make in your entire life. And you should choose wisely. Certainly don't throw caution to the wind. You can always get another truck or another house, but it's very expensive and it can break your heart if you marry the wrong woman.
That's right.
Yes, sir. As the old song goes, sometimes it's cheaper to keep her.
Somebody likes country western, huh?
But, you know, if you look at a lot of very successful businesses, there's a successful couple behind them. You know, if one of them is going through, marriages all the time, there's usually other issues. I'm not saying always because you can be married to the wrong person, but, you know, I don't want to get too much off topic, but it is a good topic because it really has a lot to do with success in business, whether you're in trucking or retail or whatever, having the right life partner, that's just so important. And,
Go
ahead.
Well, one thing that's changing about that is that increasingly it's having the right man behind the woman.
Yep.
Yeah. They're taking over, and for all the right reasons. Yeah.
Yeah. Well said, you know. And, this is the best way to the easiest way to be successful is you have the right partner. Somebody who you can go to when you have those problems and you can, you can talk them over. And a lot of times your life partner will come back with great alternatives, things you never thought about.
Mm-hmm.
And you bring them to the, you bring those decisions to the problem and all of a sudden the problem gets less and less. I can tell you people, and I'll tell our listeners this, many, many years ago, our company Traffix went through a very tough time. And, an old partnership, business partnership of 17 years it just wore out. And we went our own ways. And there were a lot of problems leading up to that and even after that. And so many times, my wife and I would talk about it, and one of us was ready to quit and just give it up. And the other one would say, no, let's keep going. And, we got everybody paid and we fixed everything. And we brought the right people on board and we never looked back. But it was, had I not been with my wife, had I been with somebody else that just wasn't in sync with me, we may have just said at the same time, no, let's give it up. And we didn't. We just kept going. And that's what a good marriage is all about.
Yep.
So, Rico, from two old married guys, you're getting some great advice that was unsolicited tonight. And I really
I'm writing it down. I'm taking notes. I'm putting it down in my little notepad here. I Lord knows I need all the help I can get.
Well, yeah, you'll do all right. You're a smart guy. You'll figure it out. But you know what? If you ever need help, here's one old married guy that's full of experience. Anyways, I don't know about wisdom.
So, shifting gears a little bit, going back into the whole freight thing. I'm very interested to hear, Noel, that what's the kind of the prognosis coming out of, I don't know if we've necessarily cleared the hurdle of coming out of the pandemic, but things are kind of looking, you got more and more places that are looking at, they're starting to try to open back up for business and they're trying to get things trying to return back to normal. What are some things can we expect coming here down the pipe with things kind of maybe starting to return back to normal?
Well, I've been doing a lot of analysis about this recently. I'm preparing my latest forecast, and it's caused me to think pretty deeply. And I went back, and you talked about coming out of this pandemic. And by the way, it's not the virus we're coming out of. It's we're coming out of the reaction we had to the risk that caused us to do all these goofy things. But at any rate, I've divided this whole process into four different buckets. Each one's worth a little bit of discussion. Usually in the U.S. economy, if you, on average, not to include recessions, but on average, the combination of productivity improvement and population improvement generates somewhere between 2-3% growth every year. Sometimes it's a little less, sometimes it's a little more, but that's the momentum that the economy has, and it's no different north of the border than it is here, nor is it any different in Mexico. So that's worth 2-3%, and right now you can quantify that in dollars at about $450 billion. Big numbers, huh? So that's number one, and because we're not looking at a recession and because this trauma is slowly receding, that should happen. So that's one brick in this wall. The second one is what I call catch-up or deferred demand. We shut the economy down. Some people shut their own economies down last year, and they didn't spend money that they had to spend because they were afraid to consume services primarily, sometimes products, but mainly services. People haven't been going to Cancun. They haven't been vacationing in Victoria this year like they usually do. I'm sure the ski slopes in Whistler were much, much less crowded this year than they were a year ago. So that... And in some cases, people didn't work, so they didn't have money, but most of us kept our income, and we've got money to spend. And so we're now that we're beginning to relax a little bit, going out for dinner, taking a trip or two. I was talking to somebody who's going on a cruise first time in a year. So that's kind of a catch-up. And if you look at what we lost last year and what we've already done to catch up, by the way, you figure it's going to be about the same as normal economic growth. So one thing we should expect in the year 2021 is that growth would be double normal because last year it was half of normal. So we're making up for it. The third thing is that people are beginning to feel pretty good. And the normal economic cycle between boom and bust is really an emotional thing. When times are bad, you pull in your horns and you don't spend. And then things turn around and things begin to look good and you begin to spend more. And so we're now in a situation where the looks like the vaccines are working, the numbers are coming down both in Canada and the States, and people are saying, wait a minute, I feel pretty good. I'm going to do some stuff that I've been holding off for quite a while. That's normally how we get an economic boom. And so I figure that's worth another $400 or $500 billion for this year. That's likely. There's people feeling good. And then the final point, and I'm pretty sure this is happening in Canada as well as it is in the States, and that is the government has decided to stimulate the economy. And it turns out in last year, the government spent more than $200 billion extra that they hadn't spent the year before. Now, not all that money gets spent by the people who get it. Some of it is saved. Some of it displaces other activity that would have happened, but because of that extra money, didn't have to happen. But then some of it turns into extra spending, which is the purpose of the stimulus. And last year, for instance, I just ran these numbers. Last year in the States, the economy shrunk by about 4%. It would have shrunk by 8 or 9% if it hadn't been for the government stimulus. So basically, the federal government said, hey, all these state governors are screwing up your economy. We're going to make up for it. And for the most part, they did. And, of course, now the Biden administration wants to do more of that, even though the economy is expanding quite nicely without it. And so we're going to get another maybe $500-600 billion in that. So what that does is to provide a pretty good upside scenario. Now, maybe not all these things will happen, and we'll get 6 or 5% growth rather than 9% growth in the States and something similar in Canada. But this is one of those times when I'm pretty optimistic. I don't like a lot of what's happening, but if you look at it from a quiet economic standpoint, 2021 should be a pretty ding dang good year. Now, that leaves a huge question for trucking and for brokers. When you get rapid changes in the demand for trucking, remember that we shrunk the damn industry in the second quarter last year, both in the States and in Canada, and then we released it, and now we're expanding it even more. And so a lot of fleets who had been cutting capacity this time last year are suddenly being asked to increase, and they're, if they had lost money last year, they're saying, hey, I don't want to take any risks until I get a lot more price. And so what happens whenever we get these kind of swings in demand, the fleets get behind in their recruiting. It's not that there's a fundamental driver shortage. You know, the freight's moving, so they're finding the driver somehow. But it gets harder and harder over time to hire drivers for lots of reasons, mainly, by the way, demographics. It's not lifestyle as much as it is the fact that the amount of work we want them to do is increasing at a faster rate than our populations are. But so every year it gets a little harder to find the drivers that the asset fleets need and the private fleets need. And so when there's a crisis like we've had in the last year, they get behind. And that's why we have these shortages. And that's where we are right now in the industry. Now, here's the point of this. That was pretty predictable. What we've never had before, and we may have this time, is this extended boom on top of the recovery from last year. And so far, it looks like the fleets are able to find enough drivers to begin catching up. But the question is, what happens if this thing goes on for another 6 months? Maybe they'll run out of energy. Maybe something bad will happen, and we won't get enough drivers for the first time ever. And so what we have is a situation that's workable right now, but it's close enough to problems that if something were to occur to gum up the works in terms of finding more drivers, we could have, for the first time, some real shortages of capacity. So what it looks like so far is a pretty good year for both carriers and brokers. However, I'm telling all of my clients to be really wary, because what looks like a nice, relaxed, good thing could turn into a free-for-all. So my forecast is a pretty good year, certainly the first half for sure, and probably a good second half. And the question is, can the fleets keep hiring drivers like they've been? And that's probably 80% probable, 85% probable. So a year from now, you can say, well, it all happened and things are okay. But what I'm doing is I'm telling people to be really wary and to watch closely, because if this balloon were to pop, things could get squirrely very quickly. And those brokers and those fleets and those shippers who are watching and have thought through what this could mean will have a big advantage in adjusting to a very chaotic situation. So, optimism, but be careful of too much optimism. How's that?
Right. That makes sense. Now, tell me something. If there's a shortage of drivers, just like, unfortunately, I guess truck drivers are just like trucking and a lot of other things, they become commodities, and valuable commodities, I will add.
Yes.
Will the rate, just the labor rate, will just keep rising in order to attract and to keep good drivers so they don't wander off? It's, you know, I always said retention is much cheaper than recruitment.
It sure is, but it's amazing how seldom the fleets behave that way. Well, here's what we know so far. Rates are up. They're not quite to their record. They're close. The tightness that the DAT and truckstop.com measure is slightly more than, it's more than the previous records, but there's some squirrely measurement issues there. But on the rate side, rates are approaching where they were at this time in 2018. So obviously, when there's shortages,
how long did that whole thing last? If I'm not mistaken, it started in December 2017 and went all the way to July of 2018,
right,
and then dropped like
a
balloon.
That's a great question. It both in 14 and in 18, it lasted about 9 months, just like you described. And it lasted in 18 through June because of the normal seasonal surge. So,
right,
you know, the tightness in the marketplace, the normal, the unusual tightness because of ELDs and other things going on then, occurred in January, but that was a soft time for trucking, as we all know. And when things began coming back in February and stayed strong through June, it was more seasonality. But at any rate, you're right. It lasted about 9 months. This one has the same timing, and the most likely case is we'll get the same result. The increases, by the way, are slowing. The last 2 weeks, the truck stop numbers were flat. The last 3 weeks, the truck stop tightness numbers were down, very high, but down from their peak. And I think DAT's numbers are about the same. So it looks like we're on a big high plateau, and it most likely case is that plateau will last until the summer. Now, having said that, in 2004, we had a situation where the tightness lasted for 3 years. The rates went up in 2004 and stayed high until into 2008.
Yeah, and then the crash of 2008.
Then the crash of 2008 killed it. But the so the $64 billion question here is, is this going to be like 18 or is it going to be like 04? I think it's going to be more like 18, but that's why I'm concerned, and that's why I brought up that exposure. It could run in the spot market through into next year, and you think about seasonality, if it runs through this time next year, then it'll run through June of next year because of seasonality. So now on the contract side, rates lag, and rates should be strong on the contract side the whole year. The spot side, I think they're going to start softening in the third quarter.
Well, in the real world that I live in, I live in a different world. I'm just looking at numbers that we're living every day, and it seems like on the spot side, it's insane. There are no trucks in certain areas, so you have to pay whatever the market bears.
Sure,
that's what.
That's exactly what happened in 2018.
Yep.
Yeah, markets work.
I did hear something after the last big pandemic 100 years ago with the Spanish flu.
Yeah.
When that ended, obviously people did not have the ability to discretionary spend or indiscretionary spend the way they do today. Didn't have the ability for credit. People didn't have a whole lot. But there was such a my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, there was such a pent-up demand for activity after people not having, been out and everything else, that you had the roaring 20s. Does that make sense that we would go that long again with a crazy economy because of pent-up demand for the last year? Who knows? I'm living up in Canada here, and they're talking about a third wave up here. Nothing is open the way it is down there. If you go into a restaurant...
This thing is not going to go away for another year or so. The question is our fear going to go away? Because it's the whole... as long as you brought that up, what's happening is people are getting over their fears. And they are coming to realize that this risk that the flu does, that this particular flu does raise, is not catastrophic like we thought it was a year ago. And so it's worth it to go out and live your life again. Now, you asked a question about the 20s. Go ahead.
What about the variants?
These things vary all the time. They vary all the time. This isn't the same thing that hit New York and probably infected me a year ago. They vary all the time. And by the way, they've been talking about it in the States, the numbers keep going down despite the fact that it varies. What's happening is people are slowly losing interest. Now, you asked a question about the 20s. In the first place, let's remember that the world economy did not shut down under the pressure of the Spanish flu. Yes, there was a lot of deaths. There were hospitals were full. They opened up armories to take care of people. The world didn't stop. What did stop the world in that time was World War I.
Right.
And all of Europe was shut down for, 4 years? And the U.S. basically was shut down for a year or a year and a half. As a matter of fact, the railroads were taken over by the government during World War I because they couldn't deal with the increase in traffic. So there was a big sigh of relief. There was a lot of pent-up demand that was released. But also in the 20s, we had some technological revolutions that changed the world. The bulldozer, the grader, the tractor were all popularized in those years. Washing machines and refrigerators and radios were all invented in the 20s. And a lot of construction activity, the stick-built house that we all live in now was basically perfected in the 20s. And so there was a combination of pent-up demand, but also tremendous productivity increases. I would argue with one thing you said, Chuck, and that is there was plenty of credit available in those days. Remember all the borrowing that led to the froth in the stock market. You know, that big boom in the stock market that occurred in the 20s that collapsed in October of 29, I think it was October, was all funded by credit. The other thing, of course, that happened in the 20s is people bought automobiles.
Right.
You know, prior to the, you know, I think there is a chance we could get the same thing in these 20s because of the tremendous productivity improvements from digitization. The difference between now and then, and it's a huge difference and it scares the crap out of me, is that, and I don't think the Canadian government's quite as stupid as the U.S. government, but maybe it is.
Well, I don't know
about that. Yeah, well, sure. But the U.S. government was not running the deficits they are today, that it is today, and the Federal Reserve was not printing money the way it was then. And so all of this public involvement in our economy had not developed in the 20s. You know, they only invented the income tax in the teens to pay for World War I. You know, there was no Social Security. There was none of the stuff we have today. The military was small at the end of the war. And so the downside that we're struggling with, that we may struggle with in these 20s, is how to pay for that debt. And, you know, one warning that I would give all business people, the most likely sign that this house of cards is unraveling is if we get inflation. And, of course, we haven't had it in quite a while. But if we get inflation, all that borrowing the U.S. government does, now instead of being borrowed at 1%, gets borrowed at 5 or 4 or whatever percent. So the negative thing that I'm watching more than anything else is inflation. And I urge anybody who's in business to do the same thing. Because if inflation comes in, then there will be a fairly negative reaction.
Yeah, well, I know that up here, I don't know what your interest rates are like down in the U.S., but they're really low here at an all-time low.
Oh, it's the same.
Okay.
Yeah.
But what's happened here is we've got a real estate boom all over Canada,
yep.
But even, especially in southern Ontario where we reside. And, you know, real estate, every single piece of property has a bidding war. It's unbelievable.
Think about it. Yeah, if you're only paying 3.5% or 4.5% on a mortgage nowadays, 3.5 is it less?
Yeah.
Think of how much more you can bid on the house. But if that were to go back up to 7%, the market in southern Ontario and then all through the United States would collapse in an instant.
Yeah, and here we have, you know, the city of Toronto, and some of our listeners are going to just gasp at this. In the city of Toronto, a very small house, and I mean very small, is $1 million. And I mean that's an attached home on one side. It's not quite a row house, but that's $1 million.
I'll make you a good deal on a 3,500 square foot house in Pennsylvania if you'd like. Come on down here.
I won't.
Forest View? Five bedrooms? Yeah.
So that would go for, is that a rural property? Are you out in the country?
Mine? No, I live in a small development, but it's surrounded by forest. It's wonderful.
Okay. So in the Toronto area, outside, and I'm talking about 30 miles outside Toronto, a friend of mine's daughter just bought one. It was it's a big home. It's about 6,000 square feet, four bedrooms. It's a nice home. And I think they said that their daughter paid $3 million for it.
Where's the money come from, Chuck?
You know what? People borrow, you know, the daughter's a lawyer, and she's married to she's not one of these lawyers that you read about. She's not a Hank Seaton who is well known. She's a young girl who is a lawyer that works for a firm downtown, and her husband is also a professional. He has a designation, I forget, he's in the medical field. They do okay, I'm sure, but they're not wealthy, but they got this feeling that if we don't do this now, this is our chance. And I thought, that's great, but if this thing goes sideways and they have to take a mortgage on that house at 13%, which is what my wife and I paid for our first home, now granted,
us
it was only a $60,000 mortgage, which makes a difference.
I had a 13% mortgage once.
So let me ask you something. If inflation, if we don't by some chance get inflation, but it sounds like it's right around the corner. Am I right? Because if I look at our industry, and I don't know a lot of other industries the way I know ours, but if I look at our industry and I look at somebody that wants to hire truck drivers and they can't hire them, the easiest way to get them is you pay more. And to me, the quality of employee you can get when you open up your wallet. There's great people out there, but they won't work for peanuts. So if that happens and wages go up in general because things go up, then inflation is just sitting there waiting for us around the corner. Is it not, Noel?
Yeah, well, there are lots of definitions of inflation, but the thing to remember, which you're pushing on here, is that it's a very significant psychological thing. And if you said something very powerful. You said that your daughter figures she has to get in now, because if she waits, it gets worse. And when you get inflation, the emotional thing you say is, oh, wait a minute, I better buy a car this year rather than next year, because next year it'll be $10,000 higher. And and that starts a spiral, a vicious circle, if you can imagine, which can take inflation from 0 to 10% in an instant. And, if you look at these places that have had hyperinflation, like Brazil and Argentina, or Germany in the 20s, that's the issue. The value of the dollar, either the Canadian dollar or the U.S. dollar, is a psychological thing. For instance, neither government backs their money with gold anymore.
Right.
So a Canadian dollar is worth only as much as we think it's worth. And there's no more science to it than that. I got a fancy couple of degrees, and they don't apply to this one.
Noel,
all
of a sudden the Canadian dollar is getting, it's gaining strength. What is that about? Is that because the price of oil is getting higher and we have a petrol-based currency?
I don't know. That's one you're going to have to help.
Or that's just compared to the... No. How is
compared to the U.S. dollar, maybe, yeah, but I'm not a currency trader, so I can't help you with that one.
Okay. Well, I'm just curious, because I know that our dollar seems to be gaining strength to the U.S. dollar. So I didn't
The U.S. dollar is overvalued by any any reasonable measure. So that was, and the Canadian dollar's been low against the dollar for quite a while. So it's not a surprise that it would be recovering. And remember that I would be astounded if the Canadian central bank is printing money the way the U.S. central bank is.
Just like you guys, no difference except our money's funny colors. So we're doing the same stupid stuff that America is doing.
Well, I'm wrong on that one. Then.
Yeah, definitely. We had some great leadership that was just being at the right place at the right time during the 08 crash. We just had we had good leadership in our prime minister and the guy running the Bank of Canada. They were both economists, extraordinaire, and kept Canada very strong. Didn't do anything stupid like a lot of other countries. But these guys now, they're trying to win a popularity contest with my grandkids' money.
Well, we keep electing people who say they're going to raise our benefits and cut our taxes. Those are the people we vote for, and so that's what we're getting.
I know.
You know, if I were running for government, I would run on the platform of, I'm going to cut your benefits and raise your taxes, but I'm going to do it fairly. But how many votes do you think I would get for that, Chuck?
Yeah, I don't think you'd I'll tell you what.
No.
I don't think you'd have much of a future as a politician in the nation's government.
No, I wouldn't.
Because people are just so, you know, we've become so self-centered. God forbid we had a world war at this time, because I don't think anybody would want to fight for a world war where, you know, our parents and grandparents, they didn't think twice. They went over. They did what they had to do.
Well, in part, they didn't know how bad it was going to be.
Right.
I'm writing a book on the war, and one of the takeaways is in 1939, nobody knew how bad it was going to get.
Yeah.
Let's hope it didn't happen again.
No, of course not. And I don't wish that on anybody. And if you remember when we were young, you know, Vietnam was the first war that came to our living rooms. And we were made aware of it face to face. You know, that was in the 60s.
It came to more than my living room. Yeah. I was in it.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, thank you for your service. You know, a lot of your neighbors came up to Canada to hide, and you know what? I'm not going to comment because, you know, I live 65 miles or 70 miles away from the U.S. border at Niagara Falls or Queenston, New York, or Lewiston, New York, and I would have been the last or second last year that would have had to go in. I was a, you know, perfect age.
Yeah, well, you're the same age I am.
No, I'm a little younger, but I was the last, would have been the last year called up. And
I was in the last year when there was no lottery.
Oh, okay. Listen, you guys did what you had to do. You know, your country asked you to do something, and whether you agreed with it or not, you did it. You know,
I got to go to Harvard for free.
Wow, that's worth it.
Kind of, yeah.
Were you, what branch of the military were you in, the Army?
I was a navigator on the air refueling airplanes. I was in the Air Force.
Wow.
So in those days, the big airplanes still carried a navigator, and we shot the stars and used the radar and did all that stuff. Nowadays, it's all automated.
It's all computer, I guess. Unfortunately or fortunately, we've come a long way, I guess. And like they said, the next war will be, you know, and I guess with drones and stuff, everything's going to be caught from an office somewhere.
Raises some big questions. Yeah, sure it does.
Yeah, exactly. Getting back to a little bit of business, what are your large carrier clients doing? My understanding is that when you're ordering equipment now, you can't get pricing. They'll take your order for next year because everything is booked for this year, for things like trailers and tractors. But my understanding is they won't give you a price. How are these people able to do their economic forecasts when there's no way of forecasting what equipment's going to cost them?
Well, they're assuming that they'll be able to, you know, that the rates will stay high, and that that whatever the whatever Freightliner charges them, they can pay.
Okay.
One of the things to keep in mind is that equipment orders, irregardless of the sophistication of the carrier, big versus little, emotion is still the driving force. And I'll give you a perfect example. Remember the days when there were changes in emissions and people would speed up their orders or slow them down depending on what the next emission change was? Well, there was a big change in emissions in 2003, and then there was another one in 2006. And a fleet that I knew of well did the numbers in 2003, and it said overwhelmingly that they should buy new trucks in 2003 because of the change in emissions and the loss in fuel economy and the increase in maintenance expense. But the managing board said, no, we're not going to do it. The market's soft. I'm not taking a chance. In 2006, they did exactly the same analysis, and they determined that, yes, it made sense, but it didn't make as much sense as it did in 2003. But if you remember, 2006 was a really good year in trucking, so they bought.
Yeah.
It was entirely an emotional decision. And right now, everybody is getting all these wonderful rates, and, you know, the big fleets are contract-oriented, and they're all signing nice year-long contracts or more attractive rates. And they said, no problem. And, you know, and I started in this business with Cummins engines, so my first 10 years were trying to forecast the equipment cycle, and it hasn't changed. They overorder in the good years regardless, and they underorder in the bad years regardless, unless you're Jerry Moyse. Remember, he used to run Swift?
Yeah.
Well, you may remember all the trucks he bought in 08 and 09.
Yes.
For a song.
Yeah.
Because he said, wait a minute, why, you know, I can survive for 2 years, but I can get these trucks at 30% off. So I, but most people don't do that.
All respect to him, those were probably the worst trucks ever built because we had just come into that new diesel technology and
it had
not been perfected. Yeah. But that wasn't his fault.
Yes, he bought them from Navistar, didn't he? Yeah. You're right. However, from a financial standpoint, putting aside that risk, it was a smart thing. But that isn't the way people behave.
Good.
And the OEMs don't discourage it. So
right. You know, the buying cycles that some of the large companies have just adopted. You know, they trade in trucks when they hit. Like they hit 480,000 miles, they're gone. I don't care how good a truck or bad a truck, it's gone. Just
absolutely.
And
works
for
them. Yeah, well, the most of the buying cycle is generated by the fleets managing the age of their new trucks. In good times, they shorten the age to, in essence, bank maintenance cost. In bad times, they lengthen the age to avoid capital costs and major rebuilds. And so what they're doing right now is they're saying, you know, it's been a long time since we had a recession. I better young up my fleet. I better get the average age down to 3.4 or 3.2. So in case we have a bad couple of years, I can keep those trucks.
Yeah.
Now, some fleets, like Knight, always trade on a three-year cycle because they don't want to do any maintenance.
Yeah.
But most, you know, which is most fleets are, yeah, excuse me.
Yeah. They can afford to do it because they've been doing it for so long.
Well, no, it's their model. They don't have any maintenance facilities.
Yeah.
Now, they pay a little more in what they feel is that it pays off in terms of reliability, but also in the savings in operating costs. They always have new trucks.
Yep.
Now, if you do it on a very carefully accounted basis, you're probably talking about 5 to 7 years. And that's what people like Lerner and Schneider do. And if you're a smart owner-operator, you do the same thing. But, you know, what's his name? Kevin Knight says, I want to keep it real simple. I don't want to have to mess around with all that rebuild and all that stuff. So he trades every 3 years.
Yeah,
and by the way, he makes a lot of money, as you know.
Yeah. A great company. You know, Rico and I have had several discussions on this show and privately about leasing, because for years and years, I was a huge proponent of full maintenance leases. The problem
mm-hmm.
now is they have gotten so expensive that they're unaffordable. And that's because the equipment has gotten, the capital cost itself has gotten so high that a little guy, even a big guy, unless he's hauling something that pays a whole lot of money, like air freight or something,
mm-hmm.
can't afford to do this anymore.
Well, you pay a premium if you're going to, you know, if you're going to outsource everything, that's for sure. It suggests that the leasing companies have had a lot of good business and they're raising prices, you know, because of demand. I do know that there's not near as much full service lease as there was when I was starting out. You know, well, hell, back in the 70s, Leaseway was the biggest fleet in the country.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
It's all, you know, things have changed. And one of the things with leasing used to be, didn't matter who you leased from, they were buying so many trucks at a time that they would pass that savings on to the customer. Because they were buying literally thousands of trucks. And if you dealt with somebody like a PACCAR, that was how the manufacturer, you know, you're getting dealer price. The truck was based on the capital cost of dealer cost. It was wholesale. But now, recently, we went out and we bought some really good used trucks because I didn't want to spend $200,000 for a truck. Up here in Canada, they're almost $200,000. Yeah, I had a guy call me today. Somebody put him through to me, and he wanted to know about working for us as an owner-operator. And I said, how much is this truck you're buying? And he said, $214,000. And I said, you don't know me from Adam, but I'm going to give you some great advice. Don't, whatever you do, do not buy this truck. I said, there's only 70 hours you can drive this thing in a week. And you can't make enough money on 70 hours a week to pay $214,000. And he was going to put, this is the best part of the story, the poor guy was going to put $80,000 down as a down payment.
Wow.
And he would still have payments of almost $3,000 a month, plus HST, which you get back. It's just insanity. And, you know, I talked him out of it, obviously, because with good conscience, I wouldn't want that to happen to anybody. Man, he's a young guy, 41 years old, was able to save $80,000, and he's got a wife and kids. And that's where I appeal to these guys. I said to him, this is very unfair to your wife and children. He's got a good job as a
mm-hmm.
truck driver and makes over $100,000 a year. And he says, why would you want to change that? You know, you're not going to make
people
want to
run their own business. You do,
exactly.
I do.
you know, it's the, I guess for some of these guys, it's the pride. And I understand that. But if you're going to do something, do it for money. Don't do it for less money because you're proud. That doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, my favorite business quote comes from the French philosopher Voltaire. It translates to, common sense is not very common.
I'm looking at the clock, and I tell you, when we have these conversations, it seems like we just have enough time in the day. I'm looking at the clock, and we have run completely out of time. We got about 5 minutes left in the show, and of course, you know, you have such great information, and I would love for people to be able to, if they wanted to get a hold of you and get more access to the information that you are sharing with us, how can they do that?
Oh, it's really easy. All I got to do is type Noel Perry in the internet, and my website will come up, and all my contact information is there. Noel, like Christmas, Perry, P-E-R-O-Y.
Good deal.
Thank you.
Noel, we definitely appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to come on and join here with us to share and impart the knowledge and information that you have done tonight and as you've always done. Chuck, why don't you let the good people know how they can get a hold of you, and we're going to bag this thing in the slot and
give you a call
and get ready for a break.
Yep. if anyone wants to give me a call, dial 1-800-388-4352, press extension 203. You got to press that or you won't get me, or send me an email at Chuck, C-H-U-C-K, at traffix.com. If you need to get set up with Traffix as a carrier, if you're having some issues in your business and you need a hand figuring stuff out, I'm glad to help anybody in the industry. Just give me a call. Don't bother with my Instagram thing. You know, I was telling people to get hold of me on Instagram. It's too cumbersome for this. Better to get hold of me on email or phone me. It just gives me an opportunity to give back to an industry that has given so much to my family and I. And Noel, I just got to straighten. I do have to get one fact straight. That home that was bought for $3 million was not my child. That was a friend of mine's daughter who's a lawyer up in Canada. My daughter lives in Vancouver, and I have to tell you, there you wouldn't get that house where you'd get a very small house for $3 million. It's insane.
Oh, yeah, it's worse, isn't it?
Yeah, she took me for a walk around her community in Vancouver recently and was showing me how much houses were, and I just didn't believe people could pay that much for a house, but obviously they can. Somebody's buying them. Yeah, it's just mind-boggling. Rico, I got to say something. Every week, you know, you always have to bring it to an end, so when I'm at your wedding, I want to be the guy that stands up on the mic and sends everybody home, just like you do, you know, just payback, okay, buddy?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Thanks for having me. Be safe, everyone.
Thanks so much for joining us. Really enjoyed it.
I want to say to everyone out there, thank you for taking time out of your schedule for listening in and tuning in with us tonight. You could have been anywhere else in the world, but you took a few minutes to hang out with us, and we're eternally grateful for you doing that. Tell a friend to tell a friend. We're still working on trying to get the podcast visual aid. Working diligently on that. And God willing, we will hopefully be able to pull that off coming really soon. With that being said, for Noel Perry, Chuck Snow, I'm Rico Muhammad, your host, signing off for the Racing Lanes podcast. God bless you, everybody. Good night. Be safe. Stay healthy, and as always, keep it in between the mustard and the mayonnaise. We'll talk at you next week.
Catch you on the flip-flop.